This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the February 12, 2014, Lincoln's Birthday edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I usually open the phone lines to get your takes on the world. U.S.-instigated talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority have been going on now for nearly 5 months. Their goal, we are told, is to resolve the long-standing conflict between Israel's Jews and the Palestinian people whose lands they invaded, stole, then settled, and which they still brutally occupy. The only way to do that, we've also been told, is by producing a tiny, demilitarized Arab state of dubious sovereignty in approximately 22% of what was known until 1948 simply as Palestine. I have not devoted much time to the subject because, irrespective of the outcome of these talks, it's a farce, a game being played on the long-suffering Palestinians and on the world. I do so now because there's a hint in the wind of a deal which will be hailed as a win for both sides and for the cause of peace. If it happens, even the most cynical will not dare describe it as justice. One look at the players will tell you that. On one side, there's Israel, which for decades has been supported politically and economically by the United States to a degree without precedent in the history of relations between nations. On the other, for appearance's sake, is a Hamas, whose term of president expired in 2009, and has held no new elections since. The Palestinian Authority is an instrument of questionable legitimacy to begin with, since its primary task has been to pacify the Palestinians under Israeli military occupation and keep them from threatening Israel's security. Israeli officials privately have admitted Abbas and his militia have carried out this assignment to their satisfaction. Here's former Israeli Defense Minister Ephraim Sneh writing in Yedioth Ahronot last month, quote, "Recognition of the common enemy," Sneh noted, "has yielded fruitful security cooperation both between Israel and Jordan and between Israel and the security forces of the Palestinian Authority. The political leaders both in Israel and the Palestinian Authority refuse to acknowledge this publicly for their own internal reasons," end quote. The Palestinian Authority's chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, is no less a collaborator than his boss, having been exposed in Al Jazeera several years ago as having been willing to make all kinds of deals to appease his Israeli masters. Despite having publicly resigned as the Palestinian's chief negotiator following the revelations, Erekat was soon back at his post. Assisting the two sides, positioned as, quote, the honest brokers and ostensibly representing the United States, that's you and me. This is where the farcical aspect goes off the charts. They're Martin Indyk and David Makovsky. The London-born, Australian-raised Indyk has spent the major part of his adult life working for Israel, starting at AIPAC in 1982 as research director, then moving on in 1985 to become the founding director of AIPAC's think tank, the now influential Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He worked there until 1993 when Bill Clinton called on him to be U.S. ambassador to Israel, where he served two terms, an appointment which required Congress to expedite his becoming a U.S. citizen. He is also credited with developing Washington's dual containment policy towards Iraq and Iran while working in the Clinton administration, one that fit very nicely with Israel's own foreign policy objectives. Makovsky was once my guest on Takes on the World, and not a very forthcoming one, put in 10 years as editor of the Jerusalem Post until returning to America as a senior fellow at the very same Washington Institute, a position that gave him access to Congress, where he has frequently testified as an expert on Middle East issues. His brother Michael Makovsky, by the way, is the head of JINSA, the neoconservative Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, on whose shoulders Colin Powell placed responsibility for the Iraq War, which I mention from time to time, since nobody else does. So that's the lineup, and it's important to remember its composition if there's a deal when you read or hear in the media that the two sides are having problems coming to an agreement and the Palestinian Authority is threatening to do this or that if the Israelis are not more forthcoming, and the Israelis accuse Abbas of encouraging anti-Israel incitement among West Bank Palestinians and of Israel's actions by themselves and not sufficient to do the job. You may also ask yourself why what I've just told you about the participants is never mentioned by the media, alternative as well as mainstream. Most recently, Abbas called for the U.S. and NATO troops to patrol the occupied Jordan Valley, which Israel does not want to surrender nor allow foreign troops to patrol. At other times, Abbas has been quoted as saying he would accept the Israeli military staying there for up to 5 years. And in a recent interview with the New York Times, he declared he would not allow another Palestinian intifada. Given all this, who, you might ask, is there to speak for the Palestinians? Well, for one, my guest at 20 minutes past the hour today, Mazen Kupsia, Professor Mazen Kupsia, the Bethlehem-born professor, political activist who taught genetics for years at Yale and Duke Universities before deciding to return home to Palestine and work for the liberation of his people. In the meantime, let's look at some news about some other arenas where you are not getting the full story. Let's begin with Washington's long-term efforts to overthrow the elected government of the Ukraine. What most of you have not heard, or most of you have heard recently about the country's internal conflict, was that someone, presumably the Russians, had made a very good recording of a conversation between U.S. Undersecretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland, and U.S. Ambassador to the Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, in which she used the F word in referring to the European Union. A YouTube made of the conversation quickly went viral and was even made available on the Washington Post and New York Times websites. Manuel's use of the F word was not the most important part of the conversation. What was critical but hardly commented on by the major media was what the conversation made clear. The anti-government opposition in Ukraine is being manipulated by Washington, that its leadership is considered by the Americans to be no more than a collection of puppets, each given a nickname, including a former heavyweight boxing champ, and that their strings are being pulled by Nuland. In fact, the YouTube is titled The Marionettes of Madden in Russian, and you can listen to it yourself online. Maidan is the name of the main square in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev and the center of opposition protests. A name, by the way, Kiev, that Nuland has not learned to pronounce. The State Department insisted last Thursday that despite the content of the bug conversation, the U.S. remains an impartial mediator in Ukraine. There are two other critical aspects of the story that the media has ignored. The first is that had the Ukraine decided to join the European Union, as the protesters have been demanding, as part of the deal, the country would have been subjected to an International Monetary Fund austerity program, which would have left the population as economically crippled and frustrated as were the people of Greece when they were subjected to the same thing. To the Ukrainians' rescue came Vladimir Putin, who offered to lend the government $15 billion to bring it out of its recession if President Viktor Yanukovych would sign an economic agreement with Russia instead. The second thing of which Americans are unaware, and what has not been reported, is that since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the U.S., according to Nuland, has spent $5 billion. That's $5 billion, B with a B, in attempting to undermine the Ukraine government and bring it into Washington's camp. On December 13th, Nuland spoke to the Ukrainian American Foundation and revealed that remarkable figure after giving her endorsement to the IMF austerity package. Here is a 3-minute excerpt from her talk.
I don't have to tell this crowd that these are historic and challenging times for the people of Ukraine, for the Ukrainian-American relationship, and for people everywhere who care about the future of that great country. The world is watching the drama that is unfolding in the center of Kyiv. The Euromaidan movement has come to embody the principles and values that are the cornerstones for all free democracies. What began on November 24th as a protest against President Yanukovych's decision to pause on the route to Europe has become much deeper and bigger. After blood was spilled by security forces on November 30th, the movement also became about justice and civil rights and Ukrainians' desire to have a government that respects them, that listens to them, that protects them, and that provides for them, a modern democratic government. National Monetary Fund. As you all know, and as I'm sure you just heard from Anders and other colleagues, Ukraine's economy is in a dire state, having been in recession for more than a year and with less than 3 months' worth of foreign currency reserves in place. The reforms that the IMF insists on are necessary for the long-term economic health of the country. A new deal with the IMF would also send a positive signal to private markets and would increase foreign direct investment that is so urgently needed in Ukraine. Signing the association agreement with the EU would also put Ukraine on a path to strengthening the sort of stable and predictable business environment that investors require. There is no other path that would bring Ukraine back to long-term political stability and economic growth. So it is time to finish the job. As Vice President Biden said in remarks last night, President Yanukovych has a choice. He can choose the path that leads to division and isolation, or he can take a leap and take immediate, tangible steps to defuse his country's crisis and start a genuine dialogue with the opposition and agree on a path that returns Ukraine to economic and political health. Since Ukraine's independence in 1991, the United States has supported Ukrainians as they build democratic skills and institutions, as they promote civic participation and good governance, all of which are preconditions for Ukraine to achieve its European aspirations. We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals that will ensure a secure and prosperous and democratic Ukraine.
Victoria Nuland, can you imagine someone from a foreign country coming to the United States, marching in protest against the United States, and not being sent packing on the first plane out of there? Anyway, who is Victoria Nuland? Who has been to Ukraine three times, and as I mentioned, still cannot pronounce Kiev? In short, she's a senior foreign service officer who has worked for both Democrat and Republican administrations, kind of like a female Dennis Ross. Under Bill Clinton, Nuland was Chief of Staff to Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot before serving as Deputy Director for former Soviet Union Affairs. In the Bush administration, she served as a Principal Deputy Foreign Policy Advisor to none other than Dick Cheney, and then as U.S. Ambassador to NATO. Under Obama, she was Special Envoy for Conventional Arms Forces in Europe before becoming Hillary Clinton's State Department spokesperson from the summer of 2011 until Clinton left office. Shortly afterwards, she was appointed by Obama to the post of Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. It's of no little consequence that she is married to Robert Kagan, one of the co-founders with Bill Kristol of the Neocon Project for a New American Century and its successor foreign policy initiative, which they described as PNAC II. More recently, again with Kristol, he founded the Emergency Committee for Israel, an undisguised Israel First operation that runs TV ads hammering any politician from the president to a candidate for Congress that it judges to be less than 100% loyal to Israel. In 2008, Kagan was a foreign policy advisor to John McCain, and then, believe it or not, was asked by Secretary of State Clinton to be on her foreign affairs policy board. With wife Victoria Nuland acting as Hillary's spokesperson at the same time, you might say that Madam Clinton was being neoconned or neoconning us. Should she get into the White House in 2016, I suspect she'll keep on doing it. On my last program, I brought you up to date on one of the most important stories of our times, one that has largely been ignored by the mainstream media, and that's the apparent defeat, at least for the moment, of the Israel lobby and a stable of war hawks in Congress and their efforts to get the U.S. into another war for Israel. It has not been ignored either in Israel or the blogosphere, however, where writers from across the political spectrum have been performing an autopsy on AIPAC's rear setback while the supposed corpse is still warm and while clearly wounded is not yet dead. M.J. Rosenberg, a former AIPAC senior staff member and now one of its sharpest and persistent critics, was fairly gloating. He wrote, AIPAC has been doing a great job spinning its defeat on Iran sanctions. The line it has successfully put out is that it is now walking away from the GOP effort to scupper President Obama's Iran initiative because the Republicans couldn't get enough votes from Democrats to join them. Its own statement, says Rosenberg, says that it is abandoning the effort for now until it can win with a bipartisan majority, that is, after next January when it hopes to have a GOP Senate. This is partially true, Rosenberg explains, except for one glaring piece of deceit. The new sanctions bill was not a Republican bill. It was an AIPAC bill. AIPAC wrote it and asked the senators closest to it to introduce it for them. AIPAC is the only U.S. interest group opposed to Obama's negotiations with Iran. If there was no AIPAC, notes Rosenberg, a few Republicans and House members from New York and Florida would be out there yelling, but there would be no serious opposition to it. Senator Menendez, he says, owned jointly by the Israel lobby and the right-wing Cuban lobby, and Kirk, who has operated like an AIPAC staffer since his own days as a congressional staffer, don't originate legislation or strategy related to Israel, including Iran. AIPAC does it for them. It's like the Israel aid component of the foreign aid bill, continues Rosenberg. When I was a staffer, he says, for Representative Nita Lowey, a member of the Appropriations Committee, AIPAC simply handed me and all the other appropriations staffers the language to be included in the foreign aid bill. Lowey and her colleagues would deliver that language to the chairman of the committee and it would be enacted precisely as written by AIPAC. End quote. That's from M.J. Rosenberg, former AIPAC staff member and editor of his Near East Report. Reporter Eli Lake, a strong supporter of Israel with equally strong connections to Israel lobby establishment, was no less direct in his comments. Writing in the online politics, Lake said, ordinarily, when Washington's most powerful pro-Israel lobby asks senators to do something, lawmakers of both parties are happy to oblige. Not just some of them, all of them. On crucial Capitol Hill votes, measures favored by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee often pass unopposed. Last week was different, very, very different. First, AIPAC was forced, in the wake of Democratic opposition, to retreat for the moment on the Iran sanctions bill the group had been pushing for months. Then nearly every Republican in the Senate ignored AIPAC's call for retreat on the bill and decided to keep on pushing for a vote on it anyway. Somehow on the issue arguably of most importance to both the Israeli government and America's pro-Israel community, Iran and its nuclear ambitions, the pro-sanctions Lake wrote, AIPAC didn't merely fail to deliver, it alienated its most ardent supporters and helped turn what was a bipartisan effort to keep Iran in check into just another political squabble. The lobby that everybody in Washington publicly backed somehow managed to pee off just about everyone. AIPAC released a statement that said, quote, stopping the Iranian nuclear program should rest on bipartisan support and that there should not be a vote at the time on this measure. So, for the moment, the push to war is averted.